You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of January 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello from Studio One here in London and welcome to Midori House. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme, from a negotiating table in Montreux to a nuclear power plant in Iran, we'll review the day's top stories with Daniela Peled and Matthew Jameson right here in the studio. Then we continue our coverage of this year's Digital Life Design event. Monocle's roving correspondent Mark Cassippi brings us the latest from Munich. And later in the show,
the exhibition actually tries to bring you along into David's work through a kind of an overall guiding theme, which is this idea of evolution. We actually focus on this period of time between Videodrome and Existence, where he's really creating these physical manifestations of his core ideas.
We'll review an exhibition on the work of master filmmaker David Cronenberg with our man in Toronto, Chris Frey. All that and more on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, right now. So, as ever, rather a lot to pack into the next 60 minutes. Before all that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news headlines from around the world.
The United Nations nuclear watchdog says Iran has started to curb its uranium enrichment work, with Iranian television saying centrifuges used for enrichment have now been disconnected. The move will lead to the easing of sanctions imposed by the European Union and the United States, allowing Iran to resume oil exports, potentially worth billions of dollars. Well, Davood Bavand, a political analyst in Tehran, says it could lead to a big change in Iran's international relations.
We are looking forward to foreign investment in Iran in different grounds. And we are certain that in the light of such a possibility, Iran economic development could be materialized. And we are going to have a good commercial, financial relationship with some other countries.
A U.S. missionary imprisoned in North Korea for more than a year appeared today in prison clothes and under guard, asking Washington to help him get home, foreign media there reported. Kenneth Bae, a 45-year-old ethnic Korean, was arrested as he led a tour group in North Korea in 2012 and sentenced to 15 years of hard labor on charges of state subversion. The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said today that there were heated discussions underway regarding this week's planned peace conference on Syria in Switzerland after the Syrian opposition threatened to pull out over a UN invitation for Iran to attend. The United States has also urged the UN to withdraw its invitation to Iran. Campaigners say the continued dispute between Muslims and Christians in Malaysia is harming the country's international image. Authorities have been accused of unfairly harassing the minority Christian population after a legal ruling that only Muslims can use the word Allah to refer to God. Malay language Bibles have been seized as a result. Well, James Chin is the head of the School of Art at Monash University in Malaysia.
This issue is driven primarily by domestic political concerns. So I think although they know that the word Allah is not exclusive to the Muslim religion for the rest of the world, I think they don't really care. I think it's quite clear that the international community suddenly realized that all this talk about Malaysia being a moderate country may not be true anymore.
East Timor has demanded that Australia return seized documents relating to the two countries' negotiations over oil and gas reserves, thought to be worth tens of billions of dollars. The case involves spy agencies, bugging allegations, and potentially huge rewards from developing the Greater Sunrise oil and gas fields located 90 miles southeast of East Timor and 280 miles northwest of Darwin in Australia. And the Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper is continuing his six-day visit to Israel, the West Bank and Jordan. He met the Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas in Ramallah and said to him that Canada would recognise a Palestinian state after Israel did. Earlier in Jerusalem, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu thanked him for supporting Israel.
When it comes to anti-Semitism, you've stood up unabashedly at the side of Israel, the entire Jewish people. And when it comes to Iran's repeated calls for Israel's annihilation and its unrelenting development of nuclear weapons, you and Canada have stood unflinchingly on the right side of history.
And for the moment, that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Do Jonathan Wheatley, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're right back after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It is just coming up to 18.06 here in London. It's 13.06 in New York City. Joining me today is Daniela Pellet, editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and Matthew Jameson, consultant fellow at the London-based think tank RUSI. Daniela, Matthew, welcome both to the programme. We're going to start our discussion with Iran. In a moment, we'll be talking about their possible appearance at this week's Syria peace talks. But first, let's go back to the last Swiss-based negotiations. Iran has today begun to dilute its uranium stockpile. It's part of an interim deal brokered over the course of 7 weeks with the so-called P5+1. That is, of course, as I'm sure you know, the permanent five members of the UN Security Council, plus Germany. Don't forget Germany. In return, both the EU and the US have said they would suspend certain sanctions for 6 months. Matthew, this is wonderful news. This shows that diplomacy works. We should all be out celebrating, shouldn't we?
Well, I think the world of international relations, especially when it comes to Iran, unfortunately is a little bit more complex. And I think that we really need to take a deep breath and a pinch of salt when it comes to the whole Iranian nuclear issue, because we've been round the block so many times on this. This has been going on now for over a decade or more. And hopefully this time we might get to a final comprehensive settlement. But this, of course, is just an interim deal. So we need to be very careful that this interim deal is fulfilled all the way. And then we'll see where we are after 6 months.
Daniela, Matthew is taking my optimism there and giving me a bit of a more realistic bent. Is he right to do that? There are lots of people who are still sceptical about this, aren't there?
I think there's room for just a little bit more cautious optimism that Matthew, but still not a great deal, because we've got another 6 months to go of very stringent monitoring. And we're very, very, very far away from an actual final deal. I think both sides, all sides, in fact, their expectations are pretty high. But yeah, I would still say this is success for diplomacy. I mean, there is a process. A process is a good thing. In this case, the Israelis, as we just heard, not very happy about it, perhaps to be expected. But I think it would be very difficult for them to break out on their own without any international support, especially without America's support.
And Matthew, it's interesting that the major players around the table all seem to, in a certain way, and let's face it, this is diplomacy and, you know, people don't have to like each other, but they all seem to get on. They have a relationship, whether that's, you know, the European Union with Cathy Ashton and her team, whether that's John Kerry's team, Barack Obama's team, or whether that's the Iranians themselves. They seem to have a relationship. Now, let's for a moment ignore the people on the outside, like Benjamin Netanyahu, like the US senators who are threatening new sanctions, despite the fact they all thought sanctions were the way of getting Iran to the negotiating table. Let's ignore all that. The people around the table right now, they have a relationship, don't they?
Yes, they do. And I think that, you know, while one might be, you know, quite cynical about perhaps the eventual outcome, the actual process itself is something that I feel is the best way forward and is the only way forward, really, for dealing with this. The military option is just unthinkable. It would create a worse situation. And there's no guarantee that it would even work. It would probably just degrade their capability, but it would unleash a firestorm of all sorts of problems. So the military option has to be avoided at all costs, and we have to pursue this diplomatic process. And it is good that we're finally getting some traction. But at the same time, I think we have to be just very, very sceptical.
Daniel, I just want to pick up that point from Matthew about how, you know, the military option, how terrible the military option would be. For a long time, you know, perhaps a decade or more, diplomacy has, certainly by the major players, almost been seen to be used as if it was for military ends. That we will do as much diplomacy as we can until we can't anymore, and then, shucks, you know, here's the military option. Do you think that we may not have completely turned a corner, but at least this seems to be a discussion and a negotiation which is about finding a diplomatic solution rather than using the facade of diplomacy to eventually lead to military action?
Well, I think to a large degree, the threat of military action has been very useful for the diplomatic purpose. And Netanyahu, in particular, I mean, even now, ramping up his rhetoric has been quite a useful counterpoint to that. But I believe what he says when he says that the military option isn't off the table. I mean, Netanyahu has been fairly obsessed with the threat from Iran long before it was fashionable, even in Israeli policy circles. As I said, I don't think it's the idea of an attack without the US say so is very, very hard to imagine. But I don't think it's complete rhetoric at all.
And Israel has taken action, you know, whether it's in Iraq in the 80s or in Syria just a few years ago. Now, not necessarily, you know, completely on their own. The idea that the US would have had no idea whatsoever is perhaps wrong. But they are prepared to take action if they feel
they're prepared
it's necessary.
Yes, they're prepared to take action. There's a difference between the US turning a blind or the US actually cooperating or the US saying, no, don't do this. I mean, Israeli circles are very split on this. I've heard repeatedly from the army and the air force, yes, we have the capability, we can do it, we are prepared and we can carry this out. But that doesn't mean that there's an actual willingness to this. And Netanyahu has often seemed very, very isolated at home in his constant continuation of this existential threat from Iran.
Matthew, how isolated are those voices on the outside, be they, you know, Netanyahu's or US senators that are being a bit more hardline?
Well, in terms of actually in the United States, those voices are not really isolated at all. They're, in fact, they're probably a very significant power bloc within the ruling Democratic Party, President Obama's own congressional colleagues in the House of Representatives and the Senate. I would say the majority of them are extremely concerned, if not against, this deal. The Congress in the United States has taken a very hard line position on sanctions on Iran. So within America, actually, Mr. Netanyahu would find many allies who would agree with him. Outside of the United States, though those voices are very much isolated in Europe that wants to see this resolved through diplomacy and within peaceful means. However, in the Middle East, it's very strange. There's a very strange combination of bedfellows here because Saudi Arabia is even more probably against the Iranian regime than perhaps the Israelis are. They are extremely opposed to Iranian influence in the Middle East. They're concerned that a Shia crescent is forming that will dominate the region. And the Saudis are really very angry at the United States for giving leeway over this matter.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Israelis, obviously, they have, I think we can all agree, they have a policy of making things difficult for Iran, whether it's cyber warfare or judicious assassinations of important figures. And there's no sign that they will rein this in at all. But also the Saudis, I think the finger could be pointed at the Saudis for a number of cyber attacks, a number of assassinations. There's far more at play here than just a simple sort of bilateral war between Israel and Iran over the nuclear threat.
Let's stay with Iran because the UN's chief Ban Ki-moon has surprised everyone today by announcing that he's invited the Iranians to the Geneva 2 peace talks this week. Those talks, of course, trying to find a solution of sorts to the Syrian civil war. And pretty much nobody was happy, except, of course, for the Iranians, because, you know, everyone likes an invite to Geneva. The Syrian National Coalition, the opposition group, which was already pretty wary about coming to these things in the first place, has now said they'll pull out if Iran shows up. The Americans, too, have said, Matthew, that they don't want Iran there unless Iran are willing to accept the previous arrangements that this would lead to a transitional government and perhaps without Assad. First of all, let's look at the decision by Ban Ki-moon to make this announcement. It's been suggested that it's a bit off the cuff and he's made it without talking to anyone else. Do you think that's true?
It's very odd, and I think that probably there'll be a lot of worried figures in the United Nations Secretary General's office tonight, because it seems as though they have blindsided the Americans, who have come out and have said that this is unacceptable. We didn't know about this, and unless they officially, publicly, the Iranians sign up to the Geneva communique from the first Geneva summit in 2012, then they shouldn't come. And so I think that probably actually it looks as if that this whole thing could collapse because of the actions of the United Nations Secretary General and his invitations.
But I mean, there's an argument, Daniela, that, you know, of course Iran should be there, and you may not like them, but they are, like or not, a big player within the Syrian civil war. And if we want to try and find a solution, then we need everyone around the table that's playing a part.
Yeah, sure. So Iran should be there, and so should ISIS, and so should the al-Nusra Front, and so should the Free Syrian Army, for that matter. A lot of people should be there that aren't going to be there. The fact is that whatever expectations you might have of Geneva too, I think, they need to be lowered, and then they need to be lowered some more, and then lowered
again.
They're
pretty low as they are anyway.
As they are.
To be honest, if they start, they'll be heralded as a success.
Exactly. I mean, that's the situation we've got to try to be remotely uncynical about this. You could say that there's important. There is a process, some sort of process. So you can count Geneva 1, then you can count Geneva 2, and perhaps Geneva 3. I mean, the Geneva brand when it comes to Syria peace talks isn't a great one. But the fact is that what people are struggling to do is to bring any kind of process together. And thus far, the only people that are coming out well out of it is the Syrian regime and Assad. Because they said, OK, we'll be there. Yep, we're ready to come and talk, even though it's quite clear that your agenda is that to topple the regime. And not only that, they've indicated they're probably willing to enable some humanitarian access, to free up some routes around Damascus. So the only people really that are doing well out of this process or non-process is the regime.
Matthew, when it comes down to it, I mean, when push comes to shove, everyone will probably turn up, won't they? Because the Americans can't say, well, we're not going to turn up when they were the ones that organised it. And the opposition can hardly say, well, we're not going to go because, I mean, what other options do they have?
Well, no, I mean, no, they might not turn up at all. They have an option of not going. I mean,
But what do they get in return? If they don't go...
Well, if they don't go, the situation will probably continue even if they did go. I mean, because quite frankly, I just don't see at this point in time any possible transitional arrangement arising from Geneva 2, which would be satisfactory to the majority of the people in the country who want the Assad regime out and they want them gone. So I think really, again, we have to be very realistic. I think we're years away from the situation being resolved in Syria. I think there's going to be a lot more, unfortunately, terrible things that will happen before we'll get to a point where it will resolve itself. But it's quite understandable why they wouldn't want the Iranians there. Iran actually is, in a way, a combatant in this
But isn't that
situation.
Why then they should be there? Because this isn't about us all getting together to talk to our friends about how much we don't like the other side. Mm. This is about trying to find a solution. And, we messed around for years saying we're not going to talk to the Taliban, and now we're trying to talk to the Taliban.
Yeah, I think, but where I would disagree there is I don't really see, and a lot of people don't see, how Iran at the moment fits in to becoming part of the solution rather than part of the problem. They have not publicly committed themselves to supporting what the whole meeting is about. It's about sort of furthering the Geneva communique to bring about a transitional governing body, which would include opposition and government forces. And they haven't signed up to that. What they have been doing is that they have been commanding their proxy, Hezbollah, to intervene, which has caused significant power for the Assad regime to be able to hold on to. It has bolstered its position. They've also been supplying a lot of equipment and a lot of money to arm the regime as well. So until I think that the Iranians publicly, whatever they've said in private to the UN Secretary General is neither here nor there, publicly they need to stand up and say, we do support a process of transitioning.
Well, no, I'm with you, Steve, on this. I think that if you're going to have any kind of dialogue, a pretense at a dialogue even, you need the relevant actors. Iran is a very, very relevant actor. I mean, Russia, too, is going great guns, literally, supplying arms to the Assad regime. So I think to have even the pretense of dialogue, you do need people around the table. Doesn't seem likely we're going to have that.
We're going to hold it right there, but don't worry, we're going to come back to this issue of Syria and particularly the future otherwise of Bashar al-Assad. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Steve Bloomfield, Daniela Peled and Matthew Jameson are my guests today. We're back after this.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there, and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love, generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Over the past year, Monocle has sent its correspondents across dozens of countries on a giddying array of planes, trains and automobiles to gather up the very best in cabins, concourses, suites and tables. And we've edited these together in a photographic slideshow for you to watch at your leisure.
Japan's southerly island prefecture has everything a tropical paradise should have. White beaches, clear waters, balmy weather, and a slow pace of life. One thing that has been in short supply is high-end hospitality. The Ritz-Carlton has done its bit by opening its luxury Okinawa outpost in the Kiza Country Club.
Monocle's latest travel top 50, now playing in the films menu on monocle.com.
And you're back with Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. My guests are Daniela Peled, editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and Matthew Jameson, consultant fellow at RUSI here in London. In a moment, we're going to be talking about Kabul and the attack there over the weekend. But first, I just want to finish off on Syria. We've already sort of talked about how low the bar is. But Matthew, if I can begin with you, what could happen if these talks go ahead? What is the best case scenario?
Well, I think the best case scenario, if the talks do go ahead, would be probably that they come to an agreement to begin a process and to have a national dialogue and to work out the frameworks and the structures to put in place a transitional governing body which would meet the aspirations of the opposition and also be satisfactory to some elements in the regime. That's, you know, a pretty tough order. But if they could get some kind of framework in place for that end goal, that would be, I think, the best scenario that we could hope for.
And Daniela, that's going to, despite the fact that the rhetoric we hear from the West, that will, you know, include that government will include Bashar al-Assad.
Well, he's very far away from being, you know, our dictator of choice as he perhaps once was. But it does seem that any idea of sidelining him is out of the window. I mean, a year ago, his demise was being reported. Now, following a decision to agree to have weapons of mass destruction dismantled, and which has strengthened him. And also his insistence that really it's all about terrorism or all about jihadists, and the fact that this is also gaining some traction in Western governments has all boosted him. But again, it's completely unacceptable. I really think realistically the only thing that Western governments can do is try and work on containment and try and address the humanitarian situation, even though this is not a humanitarian crisis, this is a war.
Indeed. We're going to turn now to Kabul and the horrific attack on the Taverna restaurant, the Lebanese restaurant owned by Kamal Hamad, over the weekend. 21 people were killed, many of them expats as well, from academics to aid workers, many Afghans as well. Daniela and Matthew, it's a city you know well, and also you both knew people that that died in this attack. Matthew, if I can begin with you, it is one of those, there have been lots of attacks in Kabul over the years, but this is one of those that really hit home, and not just because there were Western people that were killed.
Yes, I mean, absolutely. I knew a colleague who unfortunately lost his life, Dr. Alexandros Peterson, who had been a scholar at the Atlantic Council and was now teaching in Kabul University. So terribly, terribly sad, and it's just shocking. Because, you know, you hear these stories all the time and they're awful. But when you know somebody, especially when it's somebody of your own generation, it really brings it home. And it's just very sad. It seems as if the situation in Afghanistan is also not getting any better at all.
And Daniela, this was a restaurant that was frequented by pretty much everyone who came through Kabul. It was the owner was a mini celebrity in the city. And also, you know, he knew that it was going to be a target. He had all sorts of security arrangements. He was armed himself. He went out to take on the attackers himself.
Yeah, this is the strange thing. It was seen as one of the safer places to go in Kabul. I used to meet people there from the UN who had serious security restrictions. They used to come there in their jeeps wearing their bulletproof vests, where there was the journalists would just sort of rock up in a cab. It was very famous for the free chocolate cake you got at the end of the meal. But the Taliban is sending a very clear message here. They're saying, you know, no more, we don't want you here. You know, no more cappuccinos, no more free chocolate cake. Rich Afghans and Westerners, sorry, we can do this and we're going to do this.
And these sorts of attacks, you know, we saw in Nairobi last year, the attack on the Westgate Mall, which was again targeting something that was, although actually used by Kenyans of all stripes, was seen as a symbol of Kenya's burgeoning middle class. That if you have attacks on places like this, then it is reported all around the world and sends that message that you are strong and that you can take these people on.
Yeah, look, I mean, the another fairly recent attack was on the Intercontinental in Kabul, which was a very, very glitzy venue where rich Afghans would have their weddings and so on. And there was a battle there that went on for days and days and days. Apparently, the Afghan National Police Force acquitted themselves quite well, but that's not what's reported. And also what isn't reported is that enormous number of attacks that fail or are thwarted or people blow themselves up without killing anybody. I mean, this is a constant battle. And I think the idea was that post-withdrawal, Kabul and some areas around the main cities would remain safe havens, and there'd be an accommodation with the Taliban over the south of the country. The Taliban are saying, you know what, that's not good enough for us.
Matthew, if we go back 30-odd years, when the Russians left Kabul, the president who they'd supported didn't last very long. Within months, he was hanging from a lamppost, and the city had fallen. Are there fears that something similar is going to happen now when the Americans and the other NATO forces finally leave?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And this is why there's all this wrangling going on behind the scenes about a final status of forces agreement, which Karzai has not signed and is sort of, you know, using that as a political tool to sort of beat the Americans with. The great game, as it's known in that area, is being played out. Around Afghanistan, you have Pakistan, you have Iran, you have India, you have major regional players all vying for influence over the country. And they're just waiting, really, to assert control once NATO and the United States have wound down and eventually probably left. This is what happened after the Russians, as you said, left in the late 80s. Then, of course, the Pakistani influence grew very strongly. Indeed, of course, it was the ISI, the Pakistan Intelligence Services, that helped in a way create the Taliban in the first place.
Our friends and allies, the ISI.
Yes, yeah, indeed. So I'm sure we'll see. It's already happening, and it will probably break out into the open once 2014 has passed, to see who is actually the dominant regional power over Afghanistan.
And Daniela, just finally and briefly, back in end of 2001, beginning of 2002, the then British Prime Minister Tony Blair said, "The problem we've had with Afghanistan in the past is that we've left them alone, and that we won't make the mistake this time. We won't turn our back on the Afghan people." You know, in some ways, we really haven't over the past 10 years. But
we're about to do so now. I mean, the Afghan people have made immense leaps and strides since 2001 in terms of media, in terms of business, in terms of women's rights. It's not a question that just we went in and we said, "Oh, we're going to make things okay for you." They've been active participants in this, and I really fear for what's going to happen this year after the presidential elections, which I'm not terribly.
But is then the argument
about.
That actually there should be a Western presence then to ensure that those rights stay as they are?
Many, many Afghans want a Western military presence there, yep.
Daniela Peled, editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and Matthew Jameson from RUSI. Thank you both very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House. Still to come, we're in Madrid, we're in Munich, much more after this.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Op London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of Midori House, but before all of that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the world news headlines.
Steve, thanks very much. The United Nations nuclear watchdog says Iran has started to curb its uranium enrichment work, with Iranian television saying centrifuges used for enrichment have now been disconnected. The move will lead to the easing of sanctions imposed by the EU and the US, allowing Iran to resume oil exports, potentially worth billions of dollars. A US missionary imprisoned in North Korea for more than a year appeared today in prison clothes and under guard, asking Washington to help him get home. Kenneth Bae, a 45-year-old ethnic Korean, was arrested as he led a tour in North Korea in 2012 and sentenced to 15 years of hard labour. The United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said today that there were heated discussions underway regarding this week's planned peace conference on Syria in Switzerland after the Syrian opposition threatened to pull out over a UN invitation for Iran to attend. The US has also urged the UN to withdraw its invitation to Iran. And East Timor has demanded that Australia return seized documents relating to the two countries' negotiations over oil and gas reserves, thought to be worth tens of billions of dollars. And for the moment, that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Jonathan, thank you. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still to come, Marcus is in Munich. Chris Frey is in Toronto. We'll be in both those cities before the end of the show. But first, with the time at 19:33 in Madrid and 18:33 here in London, let's head to the Spanish capital, where Liam Aldous, our correspondent in Madrid, is ready and armed with the week's top stories. Liam, welcome to Midori House. We're going to be talking about abortion law. We're going to be talking about the king's daughter and corruption, which is a story I love. But first, let's start with something rather serious. These riots in Burgos, a city in the north. Tell us what's been happening.
Yeah, well, there seem to be rioting again around the world. There were rioting in Turkey last year and in Brazil, but now they're rioting in Burgos about an urban infrastructure project, which there were plans to remodel Main Street, which is going to cost about 8 million euros, and residents were not happy about this project, so unhappy, in fact, that they took to the streets and started very violent protests, which have resulted in about 40 people being detained. They've actually gone on for about 5 days now. And in a very rare victory, the protesters actually have succeeded, and the mayor has announced that the project will be halted indefinitely. So it's a rare victory for Spanish protesters.
Why has it come to this? Is there a sort of a disconnect really between the people and, you know, those that are supposed to be their representatives? The fact that this couldn't be solved through a more overtly democratic process. There had to be street protests which did turn violent.
Yeah, exactly. And if you talk to the protests, many of them claim that all of their concerns, all of their requests for meetings went unheeded. And so they were forced, basically, to protest violently. And I think a lot of Spaniards, particularly in the town of Burgos, in fact, seem to be very unhappy with these big-ticket projects, many of which actually caused Spain to, you know, to get into the financial doldrums in the first place. So if you look at this project, 8 million euros to spend on remodeling High Street, plus an extra 5 million euros to an underground car park when the city itself has very high unemployment. Many of them are claiming that the money should be spent elsewhere. And there's also the narrative at the moment is corruption, that favourite topic of yours. A lot of these big-ticket projects have been proven to be financed by the construction companies who are actually pressuring the politicians to build them. So there's a lot of underhand dealings going on, and I think people are just reaching breaking point.
And when you look across the country, I mean, these big-ticket items you mentioned, they were, you know, there were so many of them before the crisis. There's, you know, there are now ghost airports that no planes land at. There are all sorts of hotels built that no one's ever going to spend a night in, little sort of areas of housing where no one's ever going to live. And yet this is a new project. Are there other projects around the country which are sort of post-crisis, which people are sort of scratching their heads about sort of where the money's going to come from?
There are definitely a few, and there was a huge project that we've actually been talking about all of last year, the Eurovegas project, which in Madrid, which was very controversial, and that actually, in a shocking revelation, has actually been cancelled. So there's a lot of people relieved in Madrid. Perhaps if that was going to go ahead, that would have caused a lot of similar protests. But there's one big project that also has been cancelled, which is quite surprising.
Let's talk about abortion now. Spain is obviously a Catholic country, and in certain parts conservative with a small c. Abortion laws were changed back in 2009 when Prime Minister Zapatero, as was, brought them more in line with Spain's European neighbours, perhaps made them slightly more liberal. It seems like we're going back to the past now with Rajoy's latest announcements on abortion.
Yeah, we are, and it's quite surprising. And there were a lot of rumblings about moves to look at the abortion law again, but Rajoy surprised everyone just before Christmas by announcing that these very, very draconian changes to the law, which will basically come into effect in the next few weeks. The government has an absolute majority, so basically any policy it announces usually gets brought into law. So there's going to be very, very strict restrictions on abortion, and it's actually going to be more strict than the law that was brought in the 1980s. So a lot of people are asking why, when the government is already painfully unpopular in the polls, why is it going down the road of this very prickly issue of changes to the abortion law? And people have suggested that they're trying to appease the Catholic Church and also trying to pander to their very conservative base before the European elections.
Just finally, let's talk about corruption. And yes, the king's daughter has been involved in this corruption probe. It's the news came out a few days ago. Bring us the latest.
Yeah, it's finally happened. There were actually moves to bring her before court in April, but in a very astounding move, the anti-corruption attorney prosecuting the case actually went to extraordinary lengths to convince the judge not to call the princess before the court, and a higher judge actually overturned the judge's request. So fast forward to January, and the judge himself has actually provided a 220-page dossier outlining his reasoning for why the princess needs to be brought before the court, and she's actually been called on the February the 8th, but many people are still questioning whether that will actually happen, because the prosecutor is still trying to look through the legal handbook and find any way which will actually delay her appearance in court.
The prosecutor is trying to delay the appearance?
Yes, and this is been happening over all of last 2013. From an outsider's perspective, it seems doesn't really make sense, but it actually has led to a lot of allegations of backroom dealings between the politicians and the royal household. But the judge himself is fighting for the princess to appear before court to clear up basically and any kind of doubts and make it clear that the royals don't actually have special treatment. So the prosecuting lawyer is actually asking for 3 more witnesses to appear before court before the princess does. It's a very complicated process, but I'm sure we'll be hearing more about it.
We will indeed. I just want to ask you finally on this. I mean, how confident are Spanish people that actually, you know, Princess Cristina will go to trial and then will receive a fair trial, that actually she'll receive the sort of trial that you or I would receive if we were accused of corruption on such a grand scale?
I would say there's close to zero confidence that it will
right.
be a fair trial. Okay. I can use the zero statistic. And it's affecting, you can see how it's affecting the approval ratings of the king. Now, about 6 in 10 Spaniards believe that the king should abdicate, when it was only 2 years ago, he had an approval rating of 76%. So this is channeling into the perception of the monarchy, and it's not looking good for the king.
Although, as he is king, he doesn't actually have to care what the voters think one way or another. Liam Aldus, our man in Madrid, thank you very much indeed. Up next, we'll be crossing to Munich for a dose of DLD. That sounds a lot worse than it is, but trust me, it's fine. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders of all your favorites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favorites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
Day and night, indeed. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Steve Bloomfield. We're heading to Munich now, where our very own Marcus Hippe is at Digital Life Design 14. It's the event which brings together thinkers, opinion formers and practitioners from the digital world. Marcus, hello from Munich.
Hello there, how are you doing?
I'm very good indeed. And now, we heard from you a little bit earlier on the briefing when you very ably co-hosted the briefing from Munich. But for those that didn't listen to that, more fool them. But can you give us a little bit of a feeling for the event? What is the event and how does it work?
It's an event. It seems that pretty much everyone wants to come here nowadays. DLD is a conference that's been taking place almost for 10 years now, and the idea is that people who are working with the digital get together. It seems that there's a huge variety of, you know, different people who are coming here. I've been speaking to artists today. I've been speaking to opinion formers. There are some politicians over there. There are loads of entrepreneurs, some of them belonging to the world's most successful entrepreneurs, actually. There are loads of journalists and so on. So basically, this place is a venue where to come together and have discussions and get new ideas and get a bit of inspiration. It's It's been indeed a success. It's been told that the tickets to DLD actually belong to the ones that are most wanted in the world. And it's kind of not a wonder. It's quite a clever plan of how this whole event is being organized. First of all, the timing. This is organized every year just before World Economic Forum, which means that you get many people here who are then continuing straight to Davos after this.
Very canny.
Exactly. And besides attracting big names this way, it's also interesting how this conference has been set up. When I was following all the panel discussions and all the speeches given today, I kind of got the same funny feeling that actually there was more happening in the corridors and in the nice, relaxed lounges where people were meeting and networking.
That's one way to ask, Marcus, because, you know, from my experience, these sorts of things, and when we were at Davos last year, it's, you know, the speeches and the panel events are sort of, they're okay and they're fine and people sort of listen diligently and take some notes. But where the stuff really happens is after that. It's at lunch, it's over coffee, it's in the corridors, it's at the parties. Have you seen people doing that sort of thing, and sort of lots of swapping of business cards and surreptitious chats here and there?
Absolutely. You know, I was walking through some of those lounges I mentioned earlier, carrying my Monocle tote bag, and you wouldn't believe how long time it took me to manage to walk through those lounges and through those corridors, because there were so many people coming to talk to me and greeting.
Simply because you were carrying the Monocle tote?
Maybe they just recognize my face. Maybe I've been working for television in Finland. I think it was the bag after all. I think it's interesting. The organizers actually realize what's going on over here. So they're actually organizing a lot of evening programs. There are loads of different VIP and dinner events for networking. And as a matter of fact, I am meant to go to a party tonight as well, where I just noticed we'll be performing one of my current Swedish favorites. Eleanor Olofsdottir is the name of that musician I'm going to be seeing later on.
Well, lucky old you. As well as sort of swanning off at fancy parties, what else are you going to be doing in Munich? I understand you're going to be doing a couple of little food stories for the menu.
I am indeed. That's the plan. So first of all, tonight, before that party, I'm supposed to go for a Bavarian dinner. So I'm trying to get mentally prepared for a lot of sausages and beef and meat.
You don't need to get mentally prepared for sausages, Marcus.
And after that, actually, I've got a plan for tomorrow as well. For once, I decided not to go to the airport when it's almost too late. I want to go to Munich Airport relatively early because, you know what? There is the world's only airport brewery and beer garden there.
Really?
Yes.
Well, there we are. Well, that seems like something that's worth going in early and checking in online and making sure you've got everything sorted. Excellent. So we'll hear all those reports on this Friday's menu.
Exactly, on this Friday's menu, and actually we may be hearing more stories from DLD as well on some of tomorrow's programs. I was just going to mention before I have to rush off to that dinner about some big things that people have been talking about over here. So, for example, it's interesting, Arianna Huffington is one of those people who are continuing to Davos from here. She's president and editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post Media Group, and she's launching a comment and news website for the most powerful people in the world, and that will officially take place at the World Economic Forum.
I wonder if she'll pay her writers on that. I think it's perhaps unlikely. Marcus, here we are. I'm afraid we have to leave it there. We will, of course, check in with you all through tomorrow at Digital Life Design in Munich. That was Marcus Hippie. We're going to be going to Canada in a moment. ...1847 here in London, 1347 on the east coast of America. In a moment, we'll be heading to Canada, to Toronto indeed, to review a new exhibition on the Canadian filmmaker David Cronenberg. First, though, from Canada, this is Purity Ring with Lofty Cries. Lofty Cries there on Monocle 24. Now, we said we were going to Toronto, so let's go to Toronto. It's time for our daily review segment where we go through the best in books, theatre, art, music and cinema. And today it is art. We're heading to Toronto to look at an exhibition on filmmaker and hometown boy David Cronenberg. It's called David Cronenberg Evolution, and it's the first major original exhibition of TIFF, the Toronto International Film Festival. Our Toronto correspondent Chris Frey joins us now. Chris, welcome to Midori House.
Good evening.
So tell us a little bit about this, because we know about TIFF, we know about the Toronto International Film Festival. It's been going for several years, and it's one of the main events in Toronto. But this is the first time they've actually done a proper exhibition as well, isn't it?
Yeah, well, an original exhibition. They moved into a new permanent year-round space, I guess a couple of years ago. The venue is called the TIFF Bell Lightbox. It's a multi-theater venue. I think there's five theaters in there, and there's also an exhibition space. Their actual offices are in the building, too, TIFF's offices. But the exhibition space has been there for the first 2 years, but most of the shows that have been there so far were from other cinematheques or museums from around the world. So, for example, I think they had a show, a James Bond show there, for example. But the Cronenberg show is, he's had a long-term affiliation with TIFF. All of his films have opened here, or, I mean, actually been opening night premieres at the TIFF Film Festival. So, and he has a long-term relation with even people who work inside the festival. So it was a nice match. I mean, it's almost like a bit of a collaboration. I think David Cronenberg probably had a big part to play in the show.
Indeed. In fact, let's hear now from David Cronenberg in conversation with the artistic director of TIFF, Noah Cowan.
It's not something I could ever have created. I wouldn't have the affectionate objectivity that they had in doing the show, because there's such beautiful attention to detail, their tenacity in tracking down all these artifacts and things from the movies, in some cases reproducing them because they tend to disappear.
We've been able to actually get really signature items from different times in his career.
And just the huge central section, which David's voice is a huge part of it, but also some of the major objects, you know, from Videodrome, the pod from The Fly, a lot of the surgical instruments from Dead Ringers, costumes from Dangerous Method.
The culmination of this is probably Naked Lunch. We actually had a mugwump made that you can actually sit and get a photo taken, share a drink with him.
As soon as you walk into the room, you feel like you're actually on the set of Naked Lunch.
We have some just extraordinary objects, including an original mugwump, the notorious sex blob, fabulous centipede, and typewriters galore.
Notorious sex blob, there we are. You just heard the artistic director of TIFF, Noah Cowan, and David Cronenberg. Chris, tell us about Cronenberg's relationship with Toronto, because, you know, he was born there, he's worked there all his life. He is a Toronto filmmaker.
Yeah, he's probably the most identifiably Toronto filmmaker. I mean, there are other filmmakers who came from Toronto and have gone on to have great careers, like Norman Jewison. And there's certainly something to, in the early days when he was making films in the 70s and 80s, seeing Toronto on film, especially their use of, say, Toronto's mid-century modern brutalist architecture, which is a key feature of the city. So even if it wasn't, you know, these were maybe from the 70s and 80s, more like his B-movie or exploitation movies, horror movies, they may not have named it Toronto, but it was undisguisably Toronto. But more importantly, I think there's something about Cronenberg's sensibility or aesthetics that epitomize Toronto in a certain way, or maybe have influenced one way we think about Toronto. And it's that you have this seemingly placid, well-run city, clean and safe, but roiling beneath it, the surface, there are these dark stories of, like, hidden drives and body horror, wars between mutant telepaths, you know. So there's this feeling that Toronto, and I think other filmmakers like Adam McGoyan have picked up on it, that, you know, perhaps we're all, like, repressed perverts under the surface.
Well, in terms of your mayor, perhaps less under the surface. I mean, I'd love to see David Cronenberg do a Rob Ford biopic. Tell us about the show. I mean, what do you feel really worked about this show?
Well, it's an interesting challenge when it comes to a filmmaker. You know, what's the typical material you'd have, like costumes and script notes, still images. I mean, that can be kind of dull after a while. You're dealing with what secondary materials to an artist's work ultimately. So fortunately with Cronenberg, you do have the wonderfully bizarre props, which that clip outlined many of them, which helps express a fuller vision of his world. He's also a very articulate, deeply thoughtful interviewee. So the accompanying videos of him explaining his interests and his approach are also very useful. It's interesting that this show opened just on the heels of the David Bowie show, which was originally in London and then traveled to Toronto. And so it's nice to compare the two, one as a museum-style show on a musician and another on a filmmaker. And they're interesting contrasts because I think neither is like completely satisfying, but they each do different things very well. I'd say the David Bowie exhibit was great at providing some context for his art and showing the connections with other artists. With Cronenberg, there's less of that. It's a pretty straightforward chronological trip through his career. And, you know, he's made some unfilmable novels or films of unfilmable novels like, you know, Crash and Naked Lunch and David DeLillo's Cosmopolis. There's not those connections. Could have been made more apparent, I think, between literature and also the experimental films of the 60s, like by Jonas Mekas and Andy Warhol, that were an influence on Cronenberg. So you get less of that that I think would have given you a fuller portrait of the man.
And do you think, just briefly, that, you know, there's an issue here that obviously, you know, they are, you know, Noah Cowan and the director of TIFF, Piers Handlinger, that they're fans of Cronenberg and they've worked with Cronenberg on this exhibition. So there's not really that sort of distance between them and their subject.
Yeah, well, I guess it's a bit of a paradox, because I guess you could say Cronenberg did not work directly on the show, and he's described himself as a very, you know, unnostalgic man. Like, he doesn't look back fondly on a lot of his films and replay them, or even, like, keep a lot of the materials. So I think whatever they've you know, curated for the show, they had to pull from many different sources. But there is a long-term relationship between he and the programmers and the directors of the festival. I think that only, you know, is a beneficial thing. Like the David Bowie show, they're not going to be intensely critical affairs. They're a bit of the blockbuster shows that get people in the door. And I think on that level, it's a great introduction to his career.
Indeed, and why not? Chris Frey in Toronto, thank you very much indeed. And if you're in Toronto, you can see that show at the TIFF Bell Lightbox now. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Daniela Pellad and Matthew Jameson. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Anade Satuma and Rowena Wales. And our studio manager was Bill Lutie. Up next on Monocle 24, it's Culture with Rob Bound. Rob's joined by the one and only Boy George. Oh yes, he's discussing music old and new, as well as other bits and pieces. We're going to be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours in London. In fact, I'm going to be back tomorrow for Midori House, so do listen in then. For now, I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
It tells the story of a passion for motor racing. A legend forged over time by the pioneers of speed and great drivers. The Daytona Cosmograph. The watch made to break barriers. The watch dedicated to endurance. The watch that was born to race. Rolex.